Hello and welcome to another episode of Not Another Science Podcast. This week my co-host Emily will be interviewing Dr. Kathleen Duffin to discuss her fascinating work on fertility preservation in childhood cancer patients. Keep listening to find out how this relatively unpublicised field is reducing one of the long-term impacts on a child's life that childhood cancer and cancer treatment can have. Before we start, I'd like to mention that this podcast is sponsored by Griner Bio One, supplying laboratory, diagnostic and medical products to research institutions, higher education, the NHS and others across the UK. For details of the full product range, visit www.gbo.com.
My name is Kathleen Duffin and I am a clinical research fellow. So what that means is I'm a medical doctor, I'm a paediatrician, but I'm currently taking time out, as it were, of my clinical work to do a PhD through the ECAP program, which is the Edinburgh University Clinical Academic Track. So I'm doing my PhD with Nora Spears and Rod Mitchell, who both work in the field of fertility. And my kind of clinical interest is paediatric oncology and haematology, so childhood kind of cancer and blood disorders. And my sort of academic and research interest is fertility and reproductive medicine. So the way they sort of come together in my research life is that my PhD focuses on fertility and childhood cancer survivors. And I do different types of research. I've had a kind of bit of a roller coaster journey of PhD because of COVID and taking time off from maternity leave and things. So essentially I do some lab work where I'm looking at the effect of chemotherapy drugs on the pubertal testis. But I'm also kind of gathering data through surveys and analysing clinical data and doing sort of systematic reviews as well. So there's a few different avenues to my research.
Excellent. And do you like the fact that it's both in the lab and not?
Yeah, I do. I do now. It was quite daunting. It was kind of when I first started my PhD, the plan was that it was going to be fully lab based, doing kind of tissue culture work and doing some work with animal tissue, some work with human tissue, working across two different labs, but really it was going to be a wet lab based PhD. And then it was really because of COVID when the labs closed, and probably more impactful for me was all the childcare settings closing. So I was kind of at home with my kids for 7 months and so had to diversify. So at that point, if you asked me, I would have said it was mostly stressful and terrifying. But actually, now that some time has passed, I do really like it. I like having the diversity. I feel like I've learned a lot more different skills and techniques. And also, I've learned a lot more about the subject area because of it. You know, I feel like I've got more of a breadth of knowledge. And actually thinking about going back to clinical work, I feel like I've learned a huge amount of things that I will actually be able to apply, you know, day to day when I'm working with the patients. So yes, so I have had different feelings about that, but at the moment I feel positive about it.
Excellent. And could you explain why fertility to you is an important topic to keep in mind when treating childhood cancer patients?
Yeah, so childhood cancer overall is rare, but you know, the rates are increasing. So it's about 1900 children a year in the UK diagnosed with cancer. But the good news is that survival rates are also increasing because of sort of advances in diagnostics and treatment. So over 80% of children diagnosed with cancer will survive, which is brilliant. But the downside of that is a lot of cancer treatments are associated with kind of adverse effects in the short term and the long term. And one recognized adverse effect is negative impacts on fertility. So this has been pretty well studied, that children who are treated for cancer are less likely to become pregnant if they're a female, or desire a pregnancy if they're male, than kind of healthy, non-cancer treated controls. And we know that this is something that's important to patients and their families. It is something that people worry about. And actually, as these survival rates increase, there's lots of efforts to kind of hone treatment and continue to improve survival rates. But actually, it's not just about keeping kids alive, it's also sort of helping them to live. So, you know, we don't want the cancer patients to just survive, we want them to be able to live their lives. And, you know, having freedom of reproductive choice, you know, having a child isn't going to be for everyone, but having the freedom to make that choice is a really important part, I think, of having kind of quality of life.
Yeah, definitely. And in terms of what options are out there currently for patients, how would you go about preserving fertility in a cancer patient who hasn't started going through puberty, for example?
So yeah, before puberty, it is much more complicated. If you think about kind of conventional methods of fertility preservation that most people will be aware of, I suppose what most people know about is sperm preservation. So from kind of puberty onwards, male patients can produce sperm, which can be cryopreserved, and that's really non-invasive, it's well established, and it's quick, so it wouldn't delay treatment. And, you know, sometimes that can be possible in pediatric cancer patients, because some of them will have reached that sort of pubertal stage. But even in those patients, there are can be issues with, they've just had a cancer diagnosis, they're often with their parents, you know, are they in a mindset where they're going to be able to produce a sample like that? So, you know, it's complicated. But for prepubertal boys, it's absolutely not an option because the testis doesn't produce sperm yet. So within the testis, there are cells that would go on to kind of proliferate and develop and become the sperm producing cells. But in the prepubertal stage, there is no sperm in there. So you couldn't even sort of take a needle and aspirate it out of the testis. It doesn't exist yet. So the only option available is cryopreserving the testicular tissue in the hope that that tissue can be used in the future as a fertility preservation method, either by sort of, for example, taking these kind of pre-sperm cells, which they call them the spermatogonia, and maturing them in a lab till they kind of become sperm that could be used in IVF, for example, or perhaps taking actual strips of the testicular tissue and re-implanting it and hoping that it will kind of activate again. But at the moment, that's completely at the experimental stage. So there's some kind of promising in vitro studies and animal studies looking at these techniques, but it hasn't yet been demonstrated in humans. So testicular cryopreservation is offered to eligible boys around the UK and around the world. And, you know, hopefully some of these boys who are currently getting their tissue cryopreserved, by the time they reach the age of wanting to use the tissue, hopefully we will have a use for it. We're optimistic. And then on the female side, again, from puberty onwards, there's more established techniques and kinds of preserving mature eggs, oocytes. If it's an older person who has a partner, preserving embryos. But pre-puberty, there aren't the sort of mature oocytes to preserve. So again, it's preserving ovarian tissue. And this, I would say, is a bit farther ahead than the male side of things. So for tissue that's preserved from puberty onwards, there's been probably over 200 live births worldwide. So women who had ovarian tissue preserved, had cancer treatment or gonadotoxic treatment for some other reason, had the tissue reimplanted and have gone on to have live births. And there've been sort of three cases of younger girls who've had ovarian tissue cryopreserved, had it reimplanted and gone on to have live births. They were kind of peripubertal age, and there was one 9-year-old as the youngest. Well, she was 9 when she had the tissue cryopreserved. So that is still considered experimental for prepubertal females, but it's definitely really promising, and you know, we feel very optimistic about that as an option. Essentially, post-puberty, it's more straightforward because you can cryopreserve, you know, the eggs, the sperm, the gametes, as we call them. Pre-puberty, really the only option is cryopreserving tissue, which is a bit more invasive and is certainly more experimental.
And I suppose for a child who's dealing with a cancer diagnosis, the issue of trying to get reproductive tissue in invasive methods, I can imagine, is even much more of a psychological burden as well for the child.
Yeah, and I guess it's a decision that the family kind of takes on often, depending on the age of the child, how much the child will be involved in the discussions and the decisions. Where possible, obviously, we always try and involve children and young people in decisions about their care. And certainly with younger children who aren't sort of legally old enough to consent for treatment, we have a concept called assent, which is where you would still need legal consent from a parent or guardian, but it's sort of like the child or young person also saying that they understand and they agree with what's happening. So it would usually be discussed with them. And it's interesting because although the idea of it being a kind of a psychological burden, actually for some people it's quite a positive and hopeful thing. So maybe not thinking about the technique itself, but thinking about it in principle, the fact if you're saying to, for example, a family, okay, your child has a diagnosis of cancer and this is just, you know, devastating. It's just the worst thing that people can, it's just their worst nightmare. And they get so much information. But if one of the things someone says is, we want to preserve some of your daughter's ovary so that when she's older, she'll be able to have the option to have her own babies. As a carer or a parent, or as the child themselves, hopefully what you hear there is, oh, okay, so you think that she's going to survive. Because if she was going to die, from this cancer, why would you bother doing that? So you're telling me she's going to survive, and if she wants to, she can be a parent one day. So I think it can actually be a source of sort of positivity and hope. And yes, it is another thing to kind of think about in another procedure, but actually from the procedure point of view, it's done under anaesthetic, and it's usually done along with another procedure. So at the beginning of their sort of cancer treatment journey, patients have to undergo anaesthetics, for example, for biopsies, or sometimes to get a central line put in. So because chemotherapy drugs are really irritant to the veins, they'll put a big line into one of the big veins, into the sort of neck and the chest, and they give the chemotherapy that way. And in children, that's always done under an anaesthetic. So they're usually be getting another anaesthetic anyway. So from the patient experience point of view, it doesn't add a huge amount of kind of negative experience.
As me focusing on the doom and gloom.
You need to see both sides.
Yeah. So if some cancers are caused by inherited mutations, is it likely that the patient's reproductive tissue could also carry these mutations, and this risk of cancer might impact their own children if they were to have their own children? Or is this something to be investigated further down the line if the patient was to then use that material?
Yeah, so it really depends on the cancer type and the kind of genetics underlying it. So I suppose one thing is, you know, we're probably only scratching the surface to think of what we know about the kind of genomic side of cancer. And I think this is an area where, you know, with this kind of focus on precision and personalized kind of diagnostics and treatments, that in the future, there will be a lot more kind of personalized and specific screening. But at the moment, we do know that certain cancers have identified kind of genetic causes, or kind of what we sometimes refer to as tumor syndromes or heritability syndromes. And so any patients who have these family history of these conditions would get sort of genetic and fertility counselling around that. And it would really depend on the specific condition and the risk, how that would be approached. But for example, it might be that if they're going to have artificial reproductive technology, they can do pre-implantation genetic testing to test for it before, you know, even the pregnancy begins. Or for some conditions, it's a case of perhaps following up and testing in kind of childhood, adulthood, later in life. So it's really variable depending on the condition. There's a lot of concerns around this broad area with fertility and cancer survivors because, you know, for example, lots of people are concerned if you've had cancer treatment, because we know that cancer treatment can be damaging to DNA. But then the concern obviously is, well, what healthy DNA is being damaged? And because we're talking about germline cells, if the DNA from the germline is affected, you know, one concern people have had is, are the offspring of cancer patients more likely to have kind of birth defects, genetic abnormalities? But there doesn't really seem to be evidence to support that. Certainly the studies looking into it seem to be that there is not an increased rate of sort of fetal anomalies or birth defects in patients of cancer survivors. So it's definitely an area of interest, and it's something that people are concerned about and looking into. But I think that we can be reasonably reassuring at the moment when we counsel our patients. And when we know there are high risk groups, then, you know, we can take a sort of appropriate strategy.
So with certain cancer types, your risk will depend on if your parents or a family member has had it previously. And the example I'm coming up with is multiple myeloma. I think if you're, you know, a direct family member has had that cancer, your risk is very much increased. What about the childhood cancers? Is there anything known about an association with childhood, a survivor of childhood cancer who's then gone on to have children? Are there certain cancer types with where that association is really strong?
So yeah, there are certain cancer types that we know have a kind of genetic association, like for example retinoblastoma, which is like an eye cancer, can be associated with certain kind of genetic conditions. And there's also a condition called neurofibromatosis, which is an inherited condition. There's two main types, but that's associated with, it kind of presents with sort of skin manifestations, usually like dark patches or light patches in the skin, for example. But it can be associated with increased risks of specific known tumours. So in families who are known to have neurofibromatosis, for example, they would be screened routinely for these specific tumours. So yeah, there are a few different kind of clusters of these inherited syndromes. And it's not always the same in our paediatric population as in the adult population. I suppose in the adult population, we think about the, you know, the thing that springs to mind is the sort of BRCA, your breast cancers, your ovarian cancers. We see a slightly different groups of tumours and cancers that present in childhood compared to those that present later in life.
And I suppose the severity of impact on future fertility can depend on where the cancer arises. If it's around the pelvis, for example, you are directly targeting that site where your reproductive organs are.
Yeah.
Are there other factors that influence impact on patient fertility?
Yep. So definitely the disease itself. As you say, if you've got, well, obviously, for example, if you've got a testicular ovarian malignancy, particularly one that requires surgery, that's going to have a really significant impact. Anything that is associated with need of pelvic radiotherapy, for example, you know, if you've got a bony tumour in the pelvis and you need pelvic irradiation, as much as they'll try and target as much as possible, but, you know, for a female patient, if the uterus is irradiated, that can have really negative outcomes from a fertility point of view. So, you know, there are definitely disease factors, but it's really hugely related to the treatment as well. So we know that some cancer treatments are more toxic than others to fertility. And it's tricky with cancer treatments because there's a range of different treatments used. So we use chemotherapy, we use radiotherapy, we use surgery, and, you know, there's kind of newer therapies coming in, proton therapy and immunotherapies and things. But one of the most important things is people don't just get one treatment, you know, so it's not as if we say, okay, you've got this cancer, we're going to give you this one drug and that's it. So people get a range of different treatments. So then when we see these outcomes and side effects, how do we know which drug or which treatment has caused which side effect? And that's one of the things that we're trying to look into with our research. But what we do know is that there are definitely some chemotherapy drugs, for example, that are more dangerous to fertility than others. So like the alkylating agents, those are drugs that are things like, you might have heard names like cyclophosphamide or ifosfamide. They are really known to be very damaging to fertility, and they're used commonly in cancer treatment regimens. So in childhood cancer, patients will have a sort of treatment protocol. So when they start the treatment, there'll be a meeting of the multidisciplinary team, and they'll say, right, this is the diagnosis, this is the spread of it, it's affecting this or that part of the body, so let's come up with a treatment plan. We'll treat them according to this protocol, so they'll get these chemotherapy drugs plus or minus this radiotherapy plus or minus this surgery. And what there's efforts to do is to examine these treatment protocols and to sort of assign them risks to fertility, so that oncologists and hematologists can look at this when they're counselling their patients and say, okay, you've got this diagnosis, you're going to have this treatment protocol, and this is actually deemed very high risk, so this is someone that we need to offer fertility preservation to. Or actually, you've got this diagnosis, you're going to get that protocol, this is really low risk to fertility, so we'll discuss it with the patient because they might be concerned about it, but we wouldn't expect them to have any negative outcomes.
So the issue of fertility is very much brought up depending on the cancer type and what treatment the patient will receive.
Yeah, although it really, in theory, it should be brought up regardless, in the sense that we know that it's actually something people are aware of, and quite often patients and families will have some knowledge for some reason. You know, they've been exposed at some point to this concept, and so they have some knowledge, perhaps through someone that they've known or just from reading or in the media, that cancer treatment can affect fertility. So it's often on people's minds whether they ask about it or not. Mm. So the best practice really is to discuss it with all patients and their families, even if your discussion is to say, we wouldn't expect that this treatment will affect your fertility. So you're not going to offer fertility preservation to every patient, but you really should be discussing it with everyone. And that's something that, you know, this idea of like of communicating with and informing the patients and their families is something that I'm really interested in, and I'm involved in a kind of national audit of this practice at the moment with a group called the CCLG, the Children's Cancer and Leukemia Group, and we're trying to get information from all the centres around the UK to find out how often this is happening, because it's quite difficult to assess. And there was a study published in Archives of Disease and Childhood, which is a paediatric journal, 2 years ago I think, which suggested that fertility preservation was probably being offered to about 25% of childhood cancer patients. But actually, we don't know if that's 25% of all childhood cancer patients. And we don't know if that's the right amount in terms of how many people would be eligible for it and should be having it. And what we don't know from that either is, with the other 75%, was it discussed? Were they deemed to be low risk, so it wasn't even brought up? Was it offered and they declined it? So we're trying to find out a bit more about that.
From an outsider's point of view, that's quite a surprising figure.
Surprisingly high, surprisingly low.
surprisingly low, like 25%. But then, as you say, you don't know how feasible it is to preserve the patient's fertility.
And sometimes how appropriate it is, because actually if you've got a patient who's probably who's low risk and is unlikely to have any negative fertility outcomes, do you want to put them through a surgical procedure? It's all about balance, isn't it, of risks and benefits, because every procedure has risks associated with. So if you are going to take tissue, you do have to counsel the patient. There might be pain, bleeding, infection. You know, the thing, there are risks and side effects to everything. There could be a bit of a delay to treatment. But on the flip side, the procedure is usually quite straightforward. The complication rate is low. And if their fertility is going to be affected by their treatment, then it's probably worth the risk of a bit of abdominal pain for a day or two.
Yeah.
But actually, you know, if your fertility is unlikely to be affected, can we really justify putting patients through these procedures? So it's a really difficult situation. And I think, you know, we're still trying to make sure we're getting it right in terms of, are we offering it to the right patients and are people making informed decisions?
Mm, yeah. And how widely available is the fertility preservation procedures in the UK for childhood cancer patients?
Well, that is another thing that I'm quite interested in. In theory, of course, like all healthcare, in theory, it should be equitable across the UK. But our research suggests that it probably isn't at the moment. So cryopreservation of ovarian tissue is only performed at 3 centres in the UK, and cryopreservation of testicular tissue, for prepubertal patients, sorry, I should clarify, and for testicular tissue, it's only performed at 2 centres in the UK. But that doesn't mean that it should only be offered to patients within those geographical areas. So there are lots of networks, there's lots of communications between the teams, and what should happen is that any eligible patient is referred for the fertility preservation option that is most suitable for them. And if that's available in their treatment centre, then they can get it there. And if it's not, then arrangements should be made for it to happen kind of in collaboration with the other centre. So in theory, it should be offered to everyone. But what we're seeing is that in practice, it's really variable across the UK. So there's wider access to cryopreservation of sperm and eggs for patients who have, you know, reached puberty and can do that. But there's much more discrepancies in access to testicular and ovarian cryopreservation. And certainly work is ongoing to address this. There's, you know, say there's kind of networks and collaborations exist, and there's certainly consultations going on about trying to address equitable funding around the UK and encourage equal access. But at the moment, there are probably patients who, well, it's possible that there are patients who are not getting full and equal access to this.
And why do you think that is? The first thing that comes to my mind is some NHS centres as a whole will not have the facilities or staff to deal with fertility preservation.
If you are working in a hospital, a paediatric hospital, where on site there is a reproductive medicine unit that offers fertility preservation, then of course it's going to be more straightforward for you to refer that to your patients for so many reasons. You know, it's more, probably more likely to be in the forefront of your mind. You might already have research and clinical links with these teams. And from a logistical and practical point of view, if you can just move a patient within the same building, it's obviously much easier. Whereas if you think about obviously just the geography of the UK, some people are going to be, if you're on a site where you're not near a reproductive medicine unit, the practicalities of transporting patients who are maybe quite unwell, who need to get started with cancer treatment, who do not just exist in isolation, so have families around them, who also have other children and, you know, other commitments to consider, who can't necessarily just easily travel. You know, there's lots of kind of geographical barriers, I think. Probably awareness barriers from the point of view of the clinical teams and the patients. So, you know, what we don't know really is, do healthcare providers across the UK have the same level of knowledge and understanding of what is and isn't available? For example, testicular cryopreservation is very much still experimental, but that doesn't mean that we're not offering it. And so if there's someone who, maybe no one in this treatment centre has that as a particular interest, they might not be fully aware and have it in the forefront of their mind at all times that this is something that's really worth doing. Because actually for this patient who's sat in front of you, yeah, right now you couldn't retransplant their testis tissue to restore fertility, but actually by the time they need to use it, you might be able to. I think we don't really know yet what all the barriers are. you know, I think probably funding, geography, perhaps awareness and priorities. But that's something that we are looking into at the moment with this kind of study that I'm involved in, because what we want to do is try and identify these. But we know that the service is not equitable at the moment. We don't have a clear answer of why. So we want to try and identify, well, what are these barriers and how can we address them? Because at the end of the day, what we need to do is make sure that we're offering sort of equitable service to all the patients.
Yeah, clinicians' own interests influencing this availability is quite bad.
And I don't know if that is the case. You know, that's just sort of speculating. I think it's probably more the flip side, that if you're someone, if you work in a centre that's really focused on fertility, you know, people are going to have it at the forefront of their minds. I wouldn't suggest that any care provider would neglect to think about it. You know, I think that all paediatric oncology and haematologists are aware of the different late effects and try and mediate them, but they might not be as aware of, you know, if they don't have such active links with other networks, maybe they might not have, it might not be as easy for them to facilitate the process as it should be.
I see. Mm-hmm. And your own experience as a paediatrician who's taking time out from your medical role to do a PhD, did you feel like you were going against the status quo to do a PhD?
Not really. The ECAP program's pretty well established in Edinburgh. So for clinicians doing PhDs, it's quite well established. And I would say in pediatrics, there's definitely a growing population. So I think some specialties are maybe a bit more research active than others. And I think in pediatrics in Edinburgh, certainly anyway, we've definitely got an increasing number of academic pediatricians, which is brilliant. So I definitely felt encouraged by my kind of pediatric colleagues to go out and to do this. But I also felt like a massive imposter going into the lab, because I think people think, oh, you're a doctor, so you'll know stuff about science. But the clinical, I can't speak for everyone, but for me as a clinical doctor, I really felt like I didn't know a lot about science. You know, you realize how different it is. It was a really, really steep learning curve coming into it, but in a good way. You know, I'd say I've been lucky. I've been very well supported by my supervisors and my pediatric colleagues, but it's a bit of a different world.
And what advice would you have to medical students or medical professionals who are considering taking time out to do a PhD in whatever clinical interests that they have?
So first of all, I think do it if you can. If you think it's something that you want to do, pursue it and find a way to do it, because it's brilliant. I have no regrets about doing it. Find something that interests you, because it is, well, as you know as well, it's a long time and it's hard work, and you need to spend a lot of hours and a lot of energy thinking about something. So make sure it's something that you're happy to dedicate that much time to. And I think also, you know, kind of point of view that of maybe being more specific to clinicians than other people going to do PhDs, do be honest about what you do and don't know. So don't worry about the fact that you're coming in feeling like, you know, it's your first day of school when you start, because actually, you know, we don't have as much lab experience. You know, a lot of people starting a PhD have just done their honours degree and they've maybe just done a master's, they've got lab experience. And kind of as clinicians, we're coming into it with, for me anyway, I had done an intercalated honours degree 10 years before. So that had been the last time I'd been in a lab. So yeah, a long time ago. So, you know, but I, you know, just don't worry about that. Just be honest about it and ask for help when you need it. Because I think one thing is, you know, in clinical medicine, you get used to having to learn things quickly. So, you know, you'll be able to learn and pick things up. Just be honest about what you do and don't know, and seek out all the different learning opportunities, because actually it's a great opportunity to learn loads of things that we don't have time to learn in our clinical work, and to really, you know, take an interesting question and really delve into it and try and learn more about it and try and answer it. And you just don't have time to do that in clinical medicine. So yeah, my main piece of advice is just do it.
I think the academic and clinical side of research really complements each other. Like one can't really, success in one can't really exist without the other, for example.
Yeah, exactly. And I think it's really nice and collaborative as well. You know, I really love chatting to my sort of more scientific colleagues and my more clinical colleagues. And, you know, I think we've so much that we can share with each other and learn from each other.
Thank you so much for listening to another episode of Not Another Science Podcast. I hope you learned something new from that fascinating discussion. This podcast is brought to you by the Edinburgh University Science Media Society. In each episode, we explore fascinating themes and ideas, talk to awesome researchers about their work, and find out about the science being done by our very own staff and students here at the university and beyond. If you have any feedback for us, or if you'd like to get in touch with a question or suggestion, you can reach out to us on our Facebook page, Edinburgh University Science Media, or at our Twitter, @USCI. That's @EUSCI. You can also drop us an email at usci.podcast@gmail.com, and you can find the latest issue of our magazine at usci.org.uk.